Hi, I'm Carrie Kaufman, and I have major depressive disorder, psychotic on one occasion, with anxiety, and I have the late effects of poliomyelitis, sometimes called post-polio syndrome. Polio left me with major paralysis in most of the muscles of my left leg and some spots in my back and hips that don't work well. Major depression leaves me feeling rotten about myself, the world, and everything in it, unable to see any value to my life. Of the two, major depression is the more disabling for me. Though both polio and depression can be fatal, I am still alive and have a story to tell about recovery. I have been in some kind of therapy for most of my life. I started at about 2 years old for physical therapy and about 15 for psychiatry. I have had 5 unsuccessful suicide attempts. Suicidal ideation is a major problem for me. After a while, suicide becomes the default idea whenever I'm stressed. Susanna Kaysen eloquently describes this in her book, Girl Interrupted. During graduate school, I had a psychiatrist who killed himself, provoking me to anger and despair. I figured if an able-bodied man with a good job couldn't come up with a reason to live, his treatment wasn't going to work for me. I decided to fake it. I had a checklist of accomplishments: marriage, work, and children. I did what Herbert Simon, the Nobel Prize winner, called satisficing. Faced with a number of choices, I selected the ones that met the minimum acceptable requirements. Optimizing life decisions wasn't realistic for me, I thought. I chose a career in academics because I was always good at school and thought it would be mostly a sit-down job with a flexible schedule. I really wanted to be an astronaut, but I was satisficing. I married the first able-bodied man who asked me. He turned out to be both abusive and alcoholic, definitely a suboptimum choice. I finished my PhD at a university a few steps down in rank from where I earned my bachelor's degree, respectable, but not all that difficult to do. I had 2 healthy sons. I earned a tenured position at a state university. I had it all. It was the mid-1980s, and my university had invited Betty Friedan, the famed author of The Feminist Mystique, to visit. I attended a select gathering of faculty with her. I made a mild, non-incendiary comment. She turned toward me in a loud voice and snapped, "You're depressed!" and ignored me for the rest of the meeting. Now, some of you may be of the age to remember Betty Friedan. She was a prominent feminist. Some say the founding voice of the 20th century women's movement. So, I was outed at a professional seminar by one of the leading feminist scholars of my era. My satisficing strategy wasn't working, and I needed to change. Now, shortly after the Friedan incident, I organized a complex escape from my marriage that took me 3 years to implement. I resigned from the university, moved back to my hometown with the kids, and took the first job I found. I never told anyone why. I preferred to appear naive and stupid rather than abused and depressed. I chose incompetence over disclosure. Then I came out. I made my own decision to come out in 1992 without the help of Betty Friedan. Admitting I had a major mental illness came naturally to me. I was active in disability rights and had a physical disability that made disclosure unnecessary. The work I was doing was consistent with my being a consumer, so I really thought it was no big deal to acknowledge my psychiatric diagnosis publicly. I knew I had major depression, though my therapist coded me as adjustment disorder with depressed mood to avoid stigma. For a while, I felt like a celebrity. I know that sounds a little weird, but among disability advocates, extra points are awarded sometimes based on disability and what one achieves in the face of it. The combination of being professionally adrift, accomplished, and an emotional wreck gave me credibility among the colleagues looking to revamp the mental health system. But I didn't feel like a consumer because I was always more or less functional. I wasn't poor, and I had avoided hospitalization through strong family supports, a therapeutic lie, and a very forgiving work environment. The support groups I started were filled with people whose lives were very different from mine. I limped, had huge bouts of fatigue, couldn't think straight, and wanted to die, but other than that, I was, you know, okay. It was a game changer to finally admit that I was mentally ill. I want to put that term in quotation marks because it doesn't really explain how I feel as a person with major depressive disorder. A better term is psychiatric disability. Then I crashed and burned. In 1995, I had a nervous breakdown. This wasn't my first, but it was the one I couldn't hide. I had a job at a first-ranked university, responsible for two large federal research projects. When I slipped up, a lot of people noticed. The problem was that, unlike polio, I had no basic understanding of what was happening to me. My career was in ruins. I couldn't think coherently. The smallest decisions were impossible. I was making mistakes in reports and publications. I thought editors would check for these things, but they didn't. And I had to publish a correction to one peer-reviewed paper. I dodged interactions with colleagues, even my boss. I refused to answer the phone, open my office door. I cut myself off professionally and personally from anyone who could have helped me. My diagnosis was still adjustment disorder with depressed mood. This was more than an adjustment disorder. This was full-blown depression, and I was still faking normal. I started taking antidepressants, upping the dosage gradually, but the cognitive problems remained. I was suicidal and had a plan, one I didn't activate because I knew it would destroy my children's lives. What was left of my academic career was a tattered, embarrassing mess. So clearly, I needed a plan. I needed to heal, to recover. Now, the recovery process in physical and psychiatric rehabilitation is different. It's easier for me to stay in recovery from poliomyelitis than from major depression. Recovery in the face of paralytic polio takes years. People living with the late effects of polio are vulnerable, but they are functional if they take care of themselves physically. Another interesting fact, not everyone who contracts poliomyelitis is left with measurable paralysis. The rate of paralytic polio is about 1 in 200 cases. I contracted polio as a toddler, and I understand what that infection did to my body. There are easy metaphors for the muscles and nerves that control physical movement. What is the metaphor for psychiatric disability? A chemical imbalance? In comparison to post-polio, my experience with major depression is opaque. And by that I mean I don't see what is going on with me. I feel correct in my negative thinking, but I'm not functional when I'm depressed. Imagine the explanations for polio in the absence of any understanding of viral infection and anatomy of the neuromuscular system. I know what is going on. I don't blame myself. It wasn't my fault that I got polio. Recovery from psychiatric disability is hard to understand because I know so little about my brain and how it relates to my behavior. In many ways, I think it is my fault, because much of it is based on how I act and think. Clever as I am, I can't think my way out of major depression. As for polio, I know my muscles respond to physical exertion. But how does my brain respond when I'm under stress? How does suicide become my default course of action? Are there neural pathways in the brain associated with rumination? If I had answers to any of these questions, maybe I could figure out what best to do, or at least I'd understand what's going on. By experience, trial and error, I've settled on cognitive behavioral therapy and psychotropic drugs to handle major depression. But I want to visualize what I'm trying to strengthen or reconstruct. Is it all cognitive? When I'm feeling that life is not worth living, where does that idea come from? All living things want to live. Why would a self-aware being want to die? I know that drugs help control the symptoms, but these drugs are like a chemical bath. They wash over my whole body and brain with no fine distinctions as to parts. It's like taking aspirin for chest pain, not knowing if it's a heart attack. In psychosocial rehabilitation, I treat my symptoms without understanding why or how they occur. There are basic questions about how my brain functions, and I don't have the answers. I want to see the science of psychosocial rehabilitation include knowledge of neurophysiology. For now, I'm learning about recovery under a blanket of ignorance about how my brain and body work together to maintain my health. I'll close with something I learned from Jonas Salk. I started a support group for people living with post-polio in 1985 and did a small study on a cohort of survivors. I met Jonas Salk, discoverer of the polio vaccine, as part of this work. At the time, he was working on how the immune system responds to viral infection. His research question was straightforward. Are there differences in the timing and strength of the response to viral infection that determines who among the population of people exposed to the polio virus developed the paralytic form of the disease? He thought there might be some vulnerability in the immune system that could predict paralysis versus complete recovery. He did not live long enough to answer that question. But several years later, I ran into a now classic concept of orchid children, those with both talents and vulnerabilities that may be related. Are there unique vulnerabilities in my brain that make me prone to major depression? Concepts of resilience and perhaps adaptability suggest that I am so prone. But at the same time, I'm intuitive. I do jump to a lot of negative conclusions, but I am too often accurate in my predictions to completely ignore them. Is this a gift? A curse? Researchers are now asking Jonas Salk's question regarding the onset of major psychiatric disability. Are there unique features of the nervous system, difficult to observe, but early indicators of vulnerability, like major depression, and also talents for art, literature, mathematics? Can we observe variations in cognitive capacities that may be early manifestations of either illness or gifts? Is there a stage in neural development that avoids disease but maintains creativity of thought? I think I have a default pathway in my brain leading to suicide. To survive, I need to get off that path. When I contracted polio, I was part of a national campaign to eradicate the disease, FDR's March of Dimes. Do we have any analogies to that in psychiatric rehabilitation? The NIMH has launched the Brain Initiative. NAMI has its campaign for the brain. How can we support the science that informs psychiatry and the rehabilitation that supports people in recovery? I would like to see discoveries in neuropsychiatry and psychiatric rehabilitation together. In the end, I am a whole person, and my brain is part of my body.